Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. This week felt long, but we officially made it to Friday. So it's time to dive into our weekly news recap where we cover the top stories that you need to know about but you might have missed. From a controversial city leadership appointment.
An official who greenlighted the botched smokestack implosion in Little Village is now set to lead the city's buildings department.
To a scandal in City Hall.
Chicago City Treasurer Melissa Conyers-Irving faces a $60,000 fine for ethics violations.
And continued pushback over police handling of a recent traffic stop.
Demonstrators furious over the deadly shooting of Dexter Reed by Chicago police took their anger directly to the police board.
To help us make sense of all of this, I'm joined by Alex Nitkin of the Better Government Association. He's the government finance and accountability reporter for the Illinois Answers Project. We've also got Brandon Pope, reporter and anchor at CW26. And joining us for the first time on the weekly news recap is Sam Charles, a Chicago Tribune reporter focused on the Chicago Police Department and criminal justice issues. We started with city council news today. Alex briefed us on Mayor Brandon Johnson's $1.25 billion bond plan. Here's Alex.
Wednesday was a really big day for this city council legislative maneuver called the Defer and Publish, the DNP, which basically just means it's a stall tactic, essentially. We're going to figure this out next meeting, not this meeting, that was kicked up by some opponents. And so that was done on Wednesday, and all this stuff is now going to be considered at this special meeting that's going to start in, let's see, 40 minutes. Thoughts and prayers to all the reporters who are going to be staying late covering all of that. To answer your question, though, this bond deal is something, or the bond proposal has been in the works within the city's planning and housing departments for a really long time, actually going back to the Lightfoot administration, basically as part of a recognition that a lot of the traditional sources of financing for a lot of city housing and economic development and sort of small business grant programs are going to start drying up, both from federal monies, from the American Rescue Plan Act that are coming toward a cliff,
yeah,
from all of these tax increment financing districts, these special districts that are going to expire. And the city within those departments has seen this as a real opportunity to sort of revamp the way that the city approaches financing all of this stuff, from this patchwork sort of ticky-tack different programs in different wards into, mm-hmm, this big comprehensive plan. We're going to borrow $1.25 billion and use it to fund all of these programs for a number of years. It's been a lot of work, I would say, to say nothing of just coming up with the actual plan of the financing, mm-hmm, but to really demonstrate to the city council and skeptical alder people that this money is going to be spent responsibly. And so there have been some amendments and yada, yada, yada. It seems like it's on the verge of finally passing now.
Well, there was action, but inaction at city council. Let's talk about that. The fact that they didn't vote, but and there was pushback in the finance committee as well here.
So they passed it eventually out of the finance committee on Wednesday after having delayed it on Monday, after having had two special committee meetings. Essentially, yeah, there was a lot of skepticism. There was arguments over exactly how much oversight the city council should have over every individual expenditure that is backed by this bond. There was some debate over, you know, one of the amendments that was added was a provision making sure that any expenditure of more than $5 million has to go back through the city council for approval. There were some folks who had wanted that threshold to be lowered to $1 million. Mm-hmm. So that was a big source of debate.
Yeah.
And eventually it made it through with $5 million. At the end of the day, I mean, I think that people should take some comfort in the fact that there was so much, you know, hours and hours and hours of hearings on this.
Mm-hmm.
There were some pretty meticulous plans that were put out, and it's a contrast to a lot of similarly large, you know, financial proposals that have just been sort of put in front of, say, the city council in the past,
right,
and said, here, vote on this. I mean, this was a big coming out for the City Council Office of Financial Analysis, which hasn't really done a whole lot, honestly, since it was created about 10 years ago. And it really there was real due diligence that was given to this. Obviously, there are still questions. There are still critics. It seems like, from what I'm hearing, will probably pass with, I don't know, between 30 and 40 votes is what I would guess. But, you know, there it has its detractors. It has a lot of skeptical older people, but it seems like it is
well,
on the verge of going through.
Before I take you out of the hot seat, I mean, speaking of skeptical older people, I mean, the alders had concerns here. There was a delay of the final vote on the $70 million for migrant care, too, right? Now, interesting that this easily passed in the budget committee, but it's facing this serious opposition, Alex, in the full city council. What do you make of that?
Well, it passed somewhat easily in the budget committee after about an hour of debate, which is, you know, arguably not a whole lot for this group of people. To go back a little bit, essentially in February, officials from the city, the state, and the county, Cook County, came together and kind of decided, acknowledged that altogether, the full force of government is going to need an additional $321 million to adequately respond to this ongoing crisis of migrant care. And they decided that they were going to split up the responsibility where the city and county would each provide $70 million. The state would provide $181 million. And kind of at the last minute, Brandon Johnson and the city reneged on that and then denied that they had ever made that commitment. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a weird episode. And now, lo and behold, you know, 6 weeks later, Brandon Johnson and his administration are coming to the city council and saying, actually, we need this $70 million,
right,
so please appropriate it for us. We had known and they had known that it was going to be an uphill fight in the city council. We know that there is a lot of pushback, especially from the city council aldermanic Black Caucus, who are hearing from a lot of constituents saying, hey, we have our own constituents who have their needs wanted to take care of before you get to the migrants. We now know also that, thanks to some Times reporting, that a lot of the whipping in the city council was done by Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County Board President, saying, hey, no, you actually need to get behind this.
Yeah.
And it passed the budget committee the other day with a, you know, somewhat divided, but pretty lopsided 20-8 vote. So it only takes two to do the defer and publish. So it all indications seem like later today, again, after another contentious and bumpy debate, will probably pass.
Mm-hmm. So, Brandon, the county and state have already committed to funding migrant services. And yesterday, Cook County commissioners unanimously approved $70 million for food aid for migrants. What would it mean, you think, politically for Mayor Brandon Johnson if his proposed spending for migrants doesn't pass?
I mean, it wouldn't be a great look, but it'd also be a reflection of the political realities and pressure he's dealing with, because there is this tension within Black wards and districts about lack of resources historically and disinvestment, and also some divisions and tension about using dollars that many feel like, oh, where is this coming from? It's coming out of nowhere to some, the general public. And so Johnson has to thread this needle of, how do we handle this growing crisis that doesn't seem to have any sort of stop at this point, while also, you know, sticking to his key tethers of his campaign, which has been about reinvesting in neighborhoods and communities. Mm-hmm. So it's just going to show that there's more division than we think within the city council, and it's going to be a harder road than he expects to try to get this solved.
Sam, city council also delayed voting on whether aldermen should have authority over using ShotSpotter, the gunshot detection system in their wards. Give us the details.
So my colleague at the Tribune, Jake Sheridan, did some pretty good reporting recently where he talked to 14 alderpersons who represent the 17 wards with the highest concentration of gun violence in the city. And broadly speaking, they are all very in favor of maintaining ShotSpotter in their wards. And, you know, I think it speaks to kind of this disconnect between anti-ShotSpotter advocates who frequently cite, you know, very valid studies that claim that, you know, ShotSpotter really doesn't elicit any sort of valuable evidentiary findings, or, you know, that it disproportionately impacts communities of color that are more impoverished. The other side of the coin here is that the older persons leading these wards are saying, actually, no, hold on. Like, it's been helpful for us to, you know, kind of elicit a more quick response from Chicago police officers when people don't call 911. ShotSpotter has helped in these neighborhoods a lot of time. Early this year, we did some reporting, my colleague Megan Crapo and I, where we found that in the last 3 years, ShotSpotter calls responded to by CPD officers. In those calls, CPD officers have rendered life-saving aid to people wounded by gunfire more than 400 times. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though ShotSpotter is completely wrong all the time. It's by no means perfect. I don't think anybody would say it is. But, you know, the reporting that the Tribune had recently from my colleague Jake really, I think, illustrated how there's still a divide. Yeah. And it's not settled at all.
And I think it also underscores that there activists speak and, you know, the activist movements sometimes are not always in lockstep completely with what people on the ground always want. Oftentimes, when you go to South and West Side wards and talk to the people that actually live there, you'd be surprised. Mm-hmm. They want more policing. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are okay with policing. They want more of that. And ShotSpotter, whether you can argue whether it's effective or not, it at least gives them a feeling of this is a tool of safety, a mm-hmm. tool to keep our community safe. And so, you know, many aldermen say they'd like a say in that. They feel like they were blindsided by that decision, by that announcement to end mm-hmm. the contract.
So as we discussed, gentlemen, the city council delayed several decisions, but they did approve some of Johnson's staff appointments, Alex, including that controversial pick to head the city's buildings department. Who's Marlene Hopkins, and what is she going to be tasked with doing?
Marlene Hopkins was confirmed as the commissioner of the Department of Buildings. She is a quintessential City Hall veteran. She has been with the city for 25 years now. She's been with the Department of Buildings for 15 years. She has now been deputy commissioner of the Chicago Department of Buildings, which is responsible for overseeing building safety and regulations in the city under something like a half a dozen different commissioners. And we saw a lot of, you know, really effusive praise and encouragement and a unanimous vote of approval from aldermen who noted that, you know, she has been sort of a force behind the scenes, really running things kind of in the shadows, where she's an encyclopedia of knowledge on all of these things. She's been so hardworking, and now this is sort of her moment in the sun. That's sort of like her moment of justice. At the same time, on an institutional level, the Department of Buildings, there's been an increasing recognition that I think a lot of the systems that they're using are antiquated, are reactionary, or sort of responsive, are patchwork, have lots of holes in them. We, you know, at the BGA and with our partners at the Tribune have done a lot of reporting on how there are really deadly consequences to this. And the Department of Buildings, while she has been there, has been really, I would say, at best slow walking and at worst just outright refusing calls for reform, even mm-hmm. as a lot of peer cities are moving to actually modernize their building safety and buildings department. So in that context, a couple of months ago when Mayor Johnson moved to fire Matt Baudet, the commissioner of the Department of Buildings, a lot of people looked at that and said, oh, maybe the mayor is trying to take the department in a new direction. And then very shortly after that, he announced Marlene Hopkins as the pick. And it's right. like, nope, I guess not. This is all to say nothing of the public health and environmental disaster that happened 4 years ago this month when a botched demolition of a smokestack in Little Village blanketed the whole neighborhood in dust. People living there still have respiratory conditions from that. Mm-hmm. It was a huge crisis. And according to a report from the Inspector General, a report which, by the way, we only have because of reporters and the local alderman, Mike Rodriguez, who tried to pry it into public eyes when right. the city refused to release it. This 94-page report outlining thoroughly exactly what happened and what went wrong that day mentions Marlene Hopkins' name 199 times.
And the IG recommending that Hopkins be punished.
That she be reprimanded, essentially, yeah. In summary, the issue was that there was a regulatory hoop that the developer Hilco should have had to jump through that they did not ultimately jump through, that was Hopkins' responsibility. And look, like, even the report acknowledges this is not a cardinal sin. It's not something that she deserved to be fired over. And there was a lot of blame to go around for what happened. But there has been no real acknowledgement from, certainly from Hopkins herself, or from the Department of Buildings, of accountability of what went wrong. Even during the confirmation, Marlene Hopkins didn't give any remarks. She didn't say much less about the incident itself, didn't say anything about sort of what direction she wants to take the department in. Instead, whoever was responsible for her confirmation, sort of there was this rare move of trotting out all of these, I guess, character witnesses of people who have worked with her, who know her, saying, oh, she's so great, she's so hardworking. We, you know, she volunteers at her church, we all love her. And then after this, older people, one by one, lavishing praise on her, saying she's so responsive, she knows, you know, we love her so much. And even in some cases going so far as to almost intimidate people from voting against her, saying things like, you know, if anyone is even considering voting against this appointment, you better not. You better change your mind because you would be the only person doing it and you'd look really silly if you did that.
Jeez.
And so there's just no it was sort of a strange scene playing out, and there's just been no real acknowledgement at all at the city level of the Department of Buildings, except from the only time it was even mentioned really in the city council debate was Alderman Mike Rodriguez, who represents that ward where the demolition happened, saying, you know, I spoke with Marlene Hopkins and she took responsibility for what happened and she acknowledged mistakes and laid out a path for how we're going to move forward. We have no choice but to take his word on that, because as far as I know, she's never spoken publicly about it.
And Sam, if the city council drama weren't enough, Mayor Johnson had to deal with a recall petition drive. What is that about?
You know, recalls are not a thing here in Chicago for the mayor, but there is a renewed effort to make it a thing. A retired technology salesman from Lakeview has started a PAC to basically introduce a recall referendum on the November ballot. He has until early August to acquire more than 56,000 valid signatures to get that question on the ballot. And, you know, really the next time that this is even a possibility is like 2 years from now. So, I mean, the guy behind the pack, his name's Daniel Boland, and he is citing Johnson's close ties to the CTU as well as perceived rising crime rates as, you know, the last straw. Like, you know, we can't feel safe in our city, and that's kind of the impetus for this effort. However, again, he needs close to 175,000 signatures to make this even close to a reality. We'll see.
So any speculation from you then on the chances that this recall drive could be successful?
Try to avoid speculation, but you know, history, you know, past is prologue.
Brandon, City Treasurer Melissa Conyers-Irvin is facing a hefty ethics fine, one that made us raise our eyebrows. $60,000?
Yeah, it's for 12 different violations, $5,000.
Sheesh.
Each violation, yeah. It's all for things that took place between 2019 and 2022. This one has to do with an accusation that she used city resources to host a prayer service. Now, of course, she's facing another ethics investigation entirely where she was accused of firing two employees out of retaliation who were trying to warn her about potential misuse of property, of city property for personal reasons. So this makes her the first, this is the first time any elected official has been in violation of the city's main ethics law by both the ethics board and the inspector general. So, that's a hefty fine there, $60,000. It's a big one, and she's got a lot of questions to answer coming up with another ethics investigation coming up, too.
The Chicago's Board of Ethics, this one having to do with the city's whistleblower protections and misusing city property.
That's the retaliation one.
Yep. Right. Staying on the subject of ethics, though, Alex, the board also weighed in on four lobbyists who improperly donated to Johnson's political committee.
Yeah, this was a weird one. This is related to an executive order that then-Mayor Rahm Emanuel passed when he came into office in 2011, basically decreeing that if you are a lobbyist who's registered with the city, you cannot donate to the mayor's PAC, or political committee. It's pretty much flown under the radar. The ethics board acknowledged that there are four people, I think one of them was former alderman, now lobbyist Joe Moore, who were in violation of that. But then upon requesting a legal opinion and doing a little more digging, the ethics board came to the conclusion that this executive order actually has no force of law behind it, and so it is unenforceable. And so the outcome was the Board of Ethics basically going to the city council and being like, if you want this to be enforceable and real, you have to legislate it into the city code.
How did Johnson respond?
I'm not sure that he was asked about that, or
he
did.
Non-committal, I hear, just about the need for stricter ethical rules.
Yeah, I mean,
so he didn't say much.
That doesn't surprise me, and you have to forgive me. I must have missed that part of the press conference. There's usually very little on a political basis, like short-term upside for mayors to pursue things like ethics reform. I mean, usually it takes like a really high-profile indictment or, a big sort of political event like Lightfoot's election in 2019. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of these things. So I did read some coverage talking to Matt Martin, who's the alderperson, who's the chair of the ethics committee, who said that they'll take a look at that. And so I imagine something's going to be done there, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
All right, let's turn now to the latest developments in the tragic police killing of Dexter Reed. Sam, we're hearing the police officers involved had past complaints of misconduct, specifically during traffic stops. Can you fill us in?
The Dexter Reed shooting has really gripped more attention than a lot of recent police shootings, probably more than any since Adam Toledo a couple of years ago. So in the fallout, or I guess in the days since video footage of Dexter Reed's shooting was released by COPPA, accompanying documents that COPPA also released, some on their website, others via FOIA, detailed that the team of tactical officers that pulled Reed over before his shooting, they were already under investigation for allegations of improper search and seizure that are alleged to have stemmed from a very similar incident, traffic stop somewhere in the 11th District out on the west side. You know, it's worth saying that, you know, tactical officers historically are the ones in plain clothes, unmarked squad cars, and they are usually the ones who respond first and most often to very violent incidents, instances of gunfire, robberies, things like that. Mm-hmm. So, like, they're very busy, they're very active, as opposed to more plainclothes police officers. Now, like I said, the Reed shooting has really got a lot of attention, I think, in large part because of the volume of gunshots. COPPA said that the four officers who fired their weapons fired a total of 96 shots. Mm-hmm. The paperwork that the COPPA released suggests otherwise, that a total was 79. So it's somewhere in between there. One officer was said to have fired his gun more than 50 times, mm-hmm. only 23 years old, very young for a CPD officer. Police board meeting last night was very well attended, more so than any in the last year or so. At least 75 people showed up. And
yeah, hundreds of protesters. They were calling for the firing of those officers and the police superintendent. Another thing they demanded was the end of what's called pretextual traffic stops.
Right.
What exactly is that, Sam? And what are you hearing from activists and protesters?
So I was at the board meeting last night. I should say, you know, typically these things are pretty sparsely attended. It's usually like me and 10 other people just kind of hanging out and waiting to see what the board announces. But last night there was 70, 80 people who showed up. And the lion's share of them were voicing their demands that these five officers be fired, including the one who himself was shot in the wrist, according to COPPA, mm-hmm. by Reed, who fired first.
Right.
Those activists who spoke last night were demanding an end to tactical teams, plainclothes officers, an end to pretextual traffic stops. The purported cause for Reed being pulled over was that officers saw him not wearing a seatbelt. It's difficult to kind of gauge the validity of that at this point. At least Andrea Kirsten, the head of COPPA, called it into question because Reed's windows were tinted in the vehicle that he was driving. So, like last night, you know, a lot of people were calling for those five officers to be fired. It's a very long process, mm-hmm. to terminate a police officer in Chicago. It often takes well over a year, and there's a lot of different agencies that have kind of a hand in deciding, you know, who investigates what and how it's adjudicated and things like that, especially now with the future of the Chicago Police Board kind of up in the air, still pending an appeal by the FOP. So there's a lot of moving pieces to say.
Yeah. This week, we also learned new details about 26-year-old Reed, including mental health struggles, mm-hmm. in his life.
Right. In the last year of his life, I was poking around in the clerk of court's case management system, and I've learned that in 2013, in just the year before his death, Reed actually filed five separate lawsuits, acting as his own attorney in each, filing suits against Mount Sinai Hospital, against the city, against one of his former collegiate basketball teammates. These incidents kind of stem from another shooting in August of 2021, mm-hmm. when Reed was shot in the leg there by his uncle, apparently. No arrests were ever made, no criminal case was ever initiated. But according to Reed's family's attorney, he really struggled just kind of to become whole from the trauma that he was subjected to in that shooting. You know, he spent a lot of time in the hospital. He was in a coma for a while. He was reaching out, trying to use any legal remedy he could find to just basically, you know, help himself out as best he could to kind of rebuild his life. He was also arrested in July of last year, allegedly after CPD officers found him walking through the Windy City Smokeout Barbecue and Music Festival with a .357 revolver in his pocket. He didn't have a FOIA, didn't have a CCL, can't have a gun. That charge was actually still pending at the time, or that case was still pending at the time of his death. So right now, like I said, a lot of moving pieces. And it's worth noting, too, that we still, like, Dexter Reed's autopsy has not yet been released yet. Like, the officers were said to have fired 96 shots. We have no idea how many of those actually struck him.
Mm. In the midst of this, we're seeing a growing rift between Police Superintendent Larry Snelling and the head of COPPA, the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, just over how to handle the case. What's that tension there?
this started coming to a head, I think, in February. During the February police board meeting, Larry Snelling kind of went off script, or he diverted from his usual remarks during the meeting, and he instead really forcefully criticized COPA and Andrea Kirsten for, according to him, the agency's investigators are repeatedly injecting their own biases and opinions into the investigations, which are then turned over to Snelling, who must then decide whether or not allegations of misconduct are sustained. So Snelling really let Kirsten have it, gave her an earful for about 10 minutes. And so not necessarily in response to that, but in the wake of that, especially in the context of the Dexter Reed shooting, Kirsten made several more public appearances in the last week and a half or so, more than she typically does, but she didn't really say anything out of the ordinary that COPA already doesn't say
right. When
police shootings occur. COPA, as a matter of practice, puts out preliminary statements saying that, XYZ evidence that we've collected supports XYZ conclusion preliminarily.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's often years before COPA's final summary report with everything is released. Snelling first started really criticizing COPA heavily in February, and it's just kind of building and building and building. And especially with Reed shooting now, it's front and center.
Yeah. Brandon, Superintendent Snelling, as we just heard, criticized COPA for releasing that letter to news outlets and commenting on the shooting before interviewing the officers. Mayor Johnson's been saying transparency is our priority. Is it becoming clear to you that there's a struggle over how Chicago investigates police shootings?
Yeah, and it's been a long struggle. It's been more than just this year. It's been a 5-year struggle. We're still under a federally mandated consent decree that's only had 6% progress, according to the latest monitoring report, while also costing taxpayers upwards of $10, $15 million in that span just to monitor the progress on transparency and reform. So there's still a lot of questions that need to be answered on that. And there's still a lot of challenges because police officers reasonably have their concerns when it comes to, can I do the job without being hamstrung to do the job, in a sense? You have that end, but you also have the end of the folks who are like, hey, we want to know everything, see everything. We need to have a transparent process. And until there's a clear kind of meeting at the table, which I think that's what Johnson and Snelling probably need to have at this point, we haven't seen any progress yet. And you're going to have cases like this sadly come up that are going to re-inflame the conversation.
Is this case showing how hard it is to hold police accountable, Alex?
I think it is one of many, many, many cases showing the difficulty of that. I think there's one other actor in all of this that we haven't talked about, which is the new Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability, which, as I understand it, is still not fully staffed up. I mean, Sam would know more than I do, but this actually falls on the mayor, who has been overdue in appointing members of this commission, that I think especially as we see this kind of tension between the police department and the police board and COPA is going to be an increasingly important kind of mediating force.
Now, sticking with the police, Chicago's Inspector General released a report this week detailing serious misconduct. One case involved a lieutenant who didn't properly investigate a sergeant accused of sexually assaulting a member of the public. Before we hear more from you, Sam, on this report, I want to hear what the IG, Deborah Witzberg, had to say. She was on the program earlier this week.
We found that investigation was mishandled. And furthermore, the subject of the investigation, the person who had mishandled that investigation, lied to OIG about it while we were doing our work. We cannot be in a place where the police department cannot meaningfully, competently investigate its own.
So fill us in, Sam. What do we know from this report?
So in the OIG's quarterly report, they detailed an incident, several incidents that concerned two sergeants in the CPD's Bureau of Internal Affairs, which is, from the public's perspective, largely a black box. What was included in the report was basically that a sergeant who's an investigator in BIA was himself committing sexual assault against a member of the public while he was assigned as a patrol officer on the Northwest side. This went on for several years. When it came to the attention of other investigators in BIA, that investigation, for some reason that we're unclear of right now, was basically paused for about 5 years.
Okay.
And again, unclear why. And when it was taken off the shelf, nothing was sustained, basically. So the investigator who was, according to the OIG, who put it on the shelf for 5 years, she claimed that the commander of internal affairs specifically instructed her to pause it, to hold it, don't touch it. The former commander, who is now retired, lives out of state. He denied ever making that order. Mm-hmm. And OIG said that there was no documentation to support the assertion that the commander said, pause this. So between those two things, the OIG finds that the investigator assigned to the case, who had it shelved for 5 years, the OIG insists that that now lieutenant lied. And a Rule 14 violation, that's among the CPD rules that prohibit officers from lying on official reports or in just any sworn testimony. A Rule 14 violation effectively can end a police officer's career because it makes them essentially worthless in testifying in court proceedings. Once a defense attorney knows that a cop has been found to be a liar, they're never going to get called to the stand. You're never going to do any police work after that.
And so the IG is recommending what, that they get fired?
That they be fired, yes. I was told that the lieutenant who is recommended to be firing, that they are now sitting in what's known as callback, the CPD's alternate response section, which is kind of like the warehouse for officers who are under investigation, who are kind of like waiting for their cases to be adjudicated. And it's just kind of interesting that this lieutenant is now sitting in callback with a bunch of other officers who she effectively put in callback. Mm. One cop source who I talked to compared it to putting a police officer in general population.
Wow. Other cases of police misconduct included in that report that we can touch on, but I want to turn to something different here, Alex. There was anti-Semitic graffiti found at a school in Lakeview, and it comes shortly after anti-Semitic flyers were distributed in Lincoln Park. Briefly, give us the details of this.
Yeah, I don't think I need to give too many details, but like you said, I mean, there have just been some increasingly, you know, common and upsetting incidents of, you know, some schmucks and nudniks out there posting.
Has anyone been caught?
No, not as far as I know. I mean, defacing the Lakeview High School, there's been some incidents in Lincoln Park, people sort of leaving hateful flyers around, an incident in Jefferson Park. And there has been an interesting city council development with this. I don't know if this is what you were sort of leading toward, but Alderman Timmy Knudsen of the 43rd Ward in Lincoln Park has introduced this really interesting ordinance that would add a provision to the city's hate crime ordinance that would make it a finable offense to do these kinds of things. Now, yeah. Obviously, it is a crime to deface public property, but it's not a crime to, you know, distribute flyers or something like that. And so the city code defines a hate crime as like a bigoted action directed at a person, and that is like a punishable offense. It also describes hate incidents, which are something like, you know, bigoted or racist flyers being handed out, that it sort of defines, but says there isn't really anything that can be done about this. And
yeah.
So what his proposed ordinance would do is essentially to define anything that is likely to intimidate, emotionally abuse, slander, or threaten another person in reckless disregard, the risk of intimidating, emotionally abusing, or slandering a person, that would carry a $1,000 fine if mm-hmm. that is found, and that would apply to a lot of these things. And it's interesting because as these incidents have at least been more and more visible, it's put a lot of political pressure on the mayor to denounce them and be on top of them, especially in context with all of the feelings right now about Israel and Gaza.
That's a good word, yeah. The tragic situation in Gaza continues to impact us here in Chicago. We had protests in both the Loop and at the highway entrance at O'Hare. Brandon, this was in coordination with protests in other U.S. And international cities on Monday morning. They blocked the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco and the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. I mean, does it seem to you like protest tactics are just escalating?
Yeah, and I think that that's reminiscent of what's escalating over in Gaza as well. It's been,
as Alex said, feelings.
A lot of feelings and a lot of tragedy and bloodshed happening overseas. And people are feeling it in communities. Chicago has one of the largest Arab American populations in the country, Palestinian populations in the country. And these protests, pretty emblematic of that. 40 arrested after stopping traffic on the way to O'Hare Airport. Many people had to get out of their cars, get out of their Ubers, and just walk over to the terminal. Mm-hmm. I did talk to one person who was impacted by that. They ended up missing their flight. They said that as they were trying to get across, they kept being stopped from going across by the protesters, which raises a lot of questions about when does it become a protest and when does it really cross the line.
That's when it gets a little tricky.
Yeah. Like once you're physically obstructing people from actually moving, you know. 14 then arrested the same day in the Loop. There's a demonstration there. Hundreds of people gathering for an uncleared, unsanctioned protest. You have to usually do a lot of paperwork and stuff to at least get CPD on board. But now police under fire as well, because from activist groups especially, because they use the controversial tactic of kettling the protesters within Adams near LaSalle and Clark, trying to stop them and restrict them from moving further down the downtown area. But yeah, you're seeing just a lot of anger, a lot of sadness, and it's surely going to continue and ramp up as we get closer to the DNC and during the DNC. Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Preps are underway for that.
Yeah. Going to be a zoo. Last week, we talked about former Mayor Lori Lightfoot being hired to look into what's going on in South Suburban Dalton. Now, this week, a top aide to Village Mayor Tiffany Henyard was indicted. Brandon, what's going on?
That's a loaded question because there's a lot going on in Dalton and Thornton Township. So the Tiffany Henyard saga, mayor obviously under fire there for tons of things, for spending questions about, you know, town money spending. She's got questions about some accusations of covering up sexual assault. And now the latest, her chief aide, Keith Freeman, is being federally indicted for bankruptcy fraud and underreporting $95,000 in income, as well as an additional $90,000 in other income that he received. It's piling up problems in the Thornton Township and Dalton area. There's been lots of opposition there from some fellow board trustees. But now you got people that live in the area also having protests and saying enough is enough. And meanwhile, court watchers, they feel like this case with Keith Freeman, the long-term impact, while Tiffany Henyard has a lot of things spiraling around her at this point, this bankruptcy charge could be used to strike a deal with Freeman to cooperate in an investigation and potentially be a witness. If the saga with Tiffany Henyard goes toward federal or even, you know, state charges.
Do you think that's likely?
Where there's smoke, there's fire. I can't really speculate on whether, you know, she did it or not, but the accusations are there. Ben Bradley at WGN's been doing some outstanding reporting. He's got the receipts. Many have got the receipts. It's a longstanding problem, whether it's trips to Vegas, trips to Austin, you know, fancy steak dinners. And then now this issue with the Dalton trustee accused of sexually assaulting one of her former aides. And then she's accused of, when being told about this from the aide, saying, don't worry, I'll take care of it, and then firing that aide shortly after. So lots of questions still left to be answered here, but it's not looking good for Tiffany Henyard.
Now, we've had our share of April showers over the last week. Alex, you've been looking into how prepared the city and state are, though, when it comes to dealing with flooding. And that's what often comes with spring rain, unfortunately. So I'm curious what you've been finding out.
Yeah, this is a project that I and my colleagues at Illinois Answers Project have been trying to look at increasingly as understanding not just what the city is doing to try to lower greenhouse gas emissions and slow climate change, but to make itself more resilient to the effects of climate change. And basically what we found is that not just for Chicago and the region, but for the whole state of Illinois, flooding really is the biggest risk that we face, arguably, from climate change. And so we're just taking sort of a top-down look at what the city, state, county, metropolitan water reclamation district, what programs there are, what plan they have. And it's a lot. There's a lot that's being done, and there's a lot that, frankly, isn't being done, especially in terms of kind of long-term strategic vision for deciding which neighborhoods are the most vulnerable and prioritizing them. It's still, like a lot of things, very patchwork. And so we looked at a lot of different infrastructure and things like that, but I would encourage folks to stay tuned and keep reading IllinoisAnswers.org, and the series is going to keep trickling out, no pun intended. I'm sorry.
It seemed intentional.
Not trickling out.
It seemed intentional.
On the flooding story. Okay, turning to something different. The governor spent Tuesday with his big sister, Penny Pritzker, the former Commerce Secretary who Biden put in charge of Ukraine's economic recovery. The two of them were with the Ukraine Prime Minister while he was in Chicago. The visit, Alex, I mean, largely it was about asking for American military aid, right, and investment?
Yeah, I mean, on its face, it's a little bit head-scratching as to why you'd be asked, you know, in Chicago asking Congress for aid. But I think the idea was for, Ukrainian Prime Minister, his name is Denis Shmyhal, is on a kind of whistle-stop tour around the country, as far as I could tell, sort of trying to raise public support for U.S. aid to military aid to Ukraine. This is something that is obviously pending in Congress right now, and I think that is moving forward, but with a lot of resistance from members of Congress who say that their constituents back home don't know why we need to spend all these billions of dollars for Ukraine. So here is Prime Minister Shmyhal talking to, you know, with photo ops with the Chicago mayor and Penny Pritzker and Illinois governor and everyone else saying, you know, basically getting on TVs in America and saying, here's why we need the support.
Mm-hmm. All right. Something totally different. Women's basketball. It's having a well-deserved moment. The WNBA draft set a new TV record. Did you watch the draft, Sam, Brandon?
I was at the Chicago Sky draft party.
What?
It was incredible.
Yeah.
So, missed the draft, caught the championship.
Caught the championship. Yeah.
There you go.
That's good enough. We'll take that.
The energy was electric, though. I mean, the optimism, the energy around women's basketball in the city, the Sky drafting Angel Reese at number 6, and Camilla Cardoso of South Carolina at number 3. We just saw these women in the Final Four duking it out. The branding opportunity that comes with it. Angel Reese, one of the biggest marketable stars out there. When I was in the media room at the draft party, one of the Sky staff told me that every 5 minutes he had 5,000 likes on one of the Angel Reese posts.
Wow.
So the engagement, he says it's higher than anything they've seen since 2021.
Every 5 minutes.
When Candace Parker came in. So yeah.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also hearing tickets for the Chicago Sky.
Gosh.
Oh, my God. They've hit sky-high levels, right?
So on Vivid Seats, section 109 for the Indiana Fever at Chicago Sky game, of course, Caitlin Clark at the Indiana Fever, $2,031 a ticket for section 109.
My goodness.
Yeah. So it's getting pretty steep out there. The phenomenon is there. But it's great for women's basketball because finally the investment, the dollars, the ratings, they're there. And that means TV deals are going to come. More opportunities are going to come, and hopefully more fans.
Oh, maybe they'll even start paying the athletes more. We'll see.
But let's clarify. Angel Reese was picked number 7, not 6.
Number 7.
Right. So, Alex, you're getting to it, because amidst all this excitement, people are talking about double standards, right, in salaries, the endorsements, even in how the WNBA players, how they're treated by media. I mean, what do you think? What are your insights?
Listen, I'm not really a basketball fan. I don't really watch the sport very much, but I did see that I don't remember if it was Caitlin Clark's or Angel Reese's contract involves, maybe you would know, Brandon, something like $70,000 a year. And it's like, is there a zero
kind of
or two
both
missing
of
from that?
Yeah,
like,
for their four-year deals, they're getting like $360,000 each, roughly.
Comparing to, I mean, NBA stars.
For four seasons.
Even imagine.
While still having to fly coach for games.
Yeah.
Which is putrid. So to fix that, I mean, it's going to be a long-term thing, but to fix that, it's on the WNBA for one. But it's also on us as fans to support, to buy merchandise, to go to the games.
Mm-hmm.
But the WNBA, the ball's in their court now, because now that they've been reaching and increasing their revenue share, this is going to skyrocket their value. So when they make their next TV deals with ESPN or whoever, they can negotiate at a higher buying power. And then they got to have a collective bargaining agreement for the players that allows them to raise that floor and ceiling overall.
Yeah, our Lisa Laba says the Sky workout facility is lousy. So talk about that.
That's,
you know,
the thing.
Double standard with the treatment.
There is. And so, but
and you got the Bulls with a nice, shiny.
Well, that's so the Sky are practicing center. Where the Bulls used to practice back in the 80s and 90s. And if you go to the Saks area now, it still looks like the Bulls practice arena of the 80s and 90s.
Gosh.
So it's time for an upgrade. And it comes at a time where the Seattle Storm and other WNBA franchises, they are investing in their own practice facilities.
Yeah.
And updated locker rooms. So all eyes are on Chicago now.
Go Sky.
They just made huge investments in finally splitting the GM and head coach position. So it's coming, I'm sure.
It's coming.
We'll see how it goes.
That's it for the Weekly News Recap. My thanks to journalists Brandon Pope with CW26, Sam Charles of the Chicago Tribune, and Alex Nitkin of the Better Government Association. Have a great weekend. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. The news cycle moves fast, so our Weekly News Recap gives us the opportunity to slow down. If you enjoy our recap as much as we do, consider leaving us a rating and liking this podcast. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around the city. Thanks for listening, and have a restful weekend.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely